So I'll say good evening again to everyone. And this is week three of our Dharma seminar on a poem called Xing Xing Ming, or Trust in Mind, by the 5th century Chinese Zen master Sangzan, who was the third ancestor counting from Bodhidharma, which is really early in the history of Zen or Chan in China. It's just beginning. So that's why this is kind of a key text, because it was at this sort of time of transition between the Buddhism that came into China from India and what became Chan and Zen practice under the influence of Chinese culture and Taoism. The opening lines, which those of you who have been here the last week or two remember, are: the great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. And that's pretty much a summation of the message of the whole poem. It's about not getting snagged by dualistic thinking, our habitual ways, of not being blown about by the eight worldly winds, pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, shame and disrepute. I made up a little jingle, a little song about that. But I find those helpful reminders, you know, when I'm getting blown by one or the other. You know, we spend a lot of time being blown back and forth between those dualities. We're always wanting more of one and less of another. And they're all ways that we separate ourselves from our moment-to-moment experience just as it is. The first week, a couple of weeks ago, we looked at the roots of this text in early Indian Buddhism, what Musong in his commentary — I didn't bring it today to show you, but I'd recommend it if you really want to read a whole commentary on this text. And it's in his introduction, he has three sections, and he calls the first section the Dharma of Trust in Mind, about the Indian roots, and then the next section is the Tao of Trust in Mind, showing how the text reflects the influence of Taoism, which I talked about last week. And today I want to look at what he calls the Chan of Trust in Mind. So how this understanding of non-duality, of not being stuck anywhere, but not in form, not in emptiness, how this understanding of non-duality was carried forward into the golden age of Chan, the Tang Dynasty, and then beyond to us today. But unlike the last 2 weeks, I want to read some sections from the text first and then comment a little more. So let's go right to the text. And I don't have that copy with me, but you can find this section that begins "when in harmony with the nature of things." Can somebody find that? That should be on the second page.
First column at the bottom.
Bottom of the first column, second page. Okay? So, anybody find that?
Yeah.
Could someone read that section for me, please? For us, Michael?
When in harmony with the nature of things, your own fundamental nature, and you will walk freely and undisturbed. However, when mind is in bondage, the truth is hidden and everything is murky and unclear, and the burdensome practice of judging brings annoyance and weariness. What benefit can be derived from attachment to distinctions and separations?
Thank you. So the fundamental nature of all things, including what we think of as me, myself, that fundamental nature is dynamic, ever-changing interconnection. And when we live in harmony with that fundamental nature, he's saying we walk freely, undisturbed. But when the mind is in bondage, we can't see that truth. Everything is murky. What is a mind in bondage? You kind of know what it feels like, don't you? We all know what it feels like. A mind attached to self-focused preferences and judgments. Have you noticed how the burdensome practice of judging brings annoyance and weariness, like he says? I have. It's exhausting. Right. Note that the translation says, what benefit can be derived from attachments to distinctions and separations? So it's not saying that in everyday life we should never make any distinctions. Of course, we have to make decisions and base them on our knowledge and values. But to the extent that we're rigidly attached to our personal agenda, to those distinctions, that excludes other points of view, and we're likely to create suffering for ourselves and others. So when we're not attached, we're not holding on to our points of view, to distinctions, then speech and action are free of that self-clinging and can be guided by what's then called discriminating wisdom. So discriminating wisdom is free of the self-interest, the self-clinging aspect. And then there's also room for compassion as well, simultaneously arising with discriminating wisdom. Okay, could someone read the next section, please? Somebody? Allison?
Sure. If you wish to move in the one way, do not dislike the worlds of senses and ideas. Indeed, to embrace them fully is identical with true enlightenment. The wise person attaches to no goals, but the foolish person fetters himself or herself. There is one Dharma without differentiation. Distinctions arise from the clinging needs of the ignorant. To seek mind with a discriminating mind is the greatest of mistakes.
Thank you. So if you wish to move in the one way, do not dislike the world of senses and ideas. This is a really key passage. Because he's saying that our non-attachment to the world of the senses and ideas should not be based on aversion. It's not a matter of loathing the world. It's a matter of fully embracing and accepting the phenomenal world, seeing clearly it, the nature of the world. And that itself is, he's saying, identical with true enlightenment. That's a pretty radical statement. And it departs from the Indian Buddhist view under the influence of traditional Brahmanism that came to emphasize, not so much in the earliest time of the Buddha, but over time became more and more of a sort of puritanical rejection or loathing of the body in the physical world. And enlightenment was a way to leave the world behind. So we find here in this hybrid of Buddhism and Taoism a kind of down-to-earth pragmatism combined with the altruism of the Bodhisattva vows, a concern with life as it is lived here and now. with a way of living lightly on this earth. Knowing that the goals we set are provisional and subject to change. So we can make goals, but we better be prepared to adapt and flex them in light of changing circumstances, right? So we can be skillful and adaptive. The last lines in this passage, to seek mind with the discriminating mind is the greatest of mistakes. They remind us that we can't seek boundless mind with discriminating mind and conventional ways of thinking, but only through our fully embodied direct experience. In his commentary, Musong says that Zen's distrust of language, you know, because Zen is always kind of saying it's beyond words, right? Or as soon as you try and put it in words, you've already distorted it, which is so. But it's not a complete rejection of language. Zen uses language creatively to subvert language and to demonstrate its limitations. The koan literature is full of that kind of playful subversion of language. What is Buddha? A dried shit stick. Have you heard that koan? Why did Bodhidharma come from the West? The oak tree in the courtyard. Yeah. Pulling the rug out from under our conventional explanations of what is Buddha, why did Bodhidharma come from the West? What's right here? What's right here in front of you? Okay, let's keep going. Someone read the next section? Jiangxi?
Rest and unrest derive from illusion. With enlightenment, attachment to liking and disliking ceases. All dualities come from ignorant ignorance. They are like dreams, phantoms, hallucinations. It is foolish to try to grasp them. Gain and loss, right and wrong, finally abandon all such thoughts at once.
Thank you. So he's talking here about dualistic thinking, right? Right and wrong, male and female, black and white, the eight worldly winds. How easily one can turn into the other. And how insubstantial they are, like dreams, phantoms. What sounds like praise to one person will sound like mockery to another. Right? Or an experience that seems like unmitigated loss will turn out to have surprising gifts. But how quickly we label in black and white terms, in dualistic terms. Okay, next section, someone?
If Ben. The eye never sleeps, all dreams will naturally cease. If the mind makes no discriminations, the 10,000 things are as they are, of single essence. To realize the mystery of this one essence is to be released from all entanglements. When all things are seen without differentiation, the one self-essence is everywhere revealed. No comparisons or analogies are possible in this causeless, relationless state of just this one.
So now he's trying to describe this state of non-discrimination that sees the 10,000 things just as they are, manifesting in any given moment, part of a great interconnected whole. The classic image is of Indra's net. Probably many of you have heard of Indra's the king of gods Indian cosmology, but this image of Indra's net came into into Buddhist cosmology or imagery, really, as a vast, limitless net, and at each node is a jewel, and each jewel reflects every other jewel in the net. It's a very remarkable kind of holographic image, which resonates with contemporary particle physics in ways that I'm not able to describe, but it's pretty remarkable. And poetic. Next short section, someone please.
When movement stops, there is no movement. And when no movement, there is no stopping. When such dualities cease to exist, oneness itself cannot exist. To this ultimate state, no law or description applies.
Thank you. So, of course, ultimately words fail to describe this. How to describe the emptiness of emptiness, within which all phenomena arise and pass away. But remarkably, as I just said, the descriptions of quantum physics come very close to describing this simultaneous reality of the relative and the absolute aspects of being. I'm going to read you a quote from David Bohm, who's a theoretical physicist, about what he calls the implicate and the explicate order. So the implicate order is the enfolded, and the explicate is the unfolded order. And don't worry about understanding his words. Just listen to me read this in the same way as you might listen to this poem. In the enfolded or implicate order, space and time are no longer the dominant factors determining the relationships of dependence or independence of different elements. Rather, an entirely different sort of basic connection of elements is possible, from which our ordinary notions of space and time, along with those of separately existent material particles, are abstracted as forms derived from the deeper order. These ordinary notions, in fact, appear in what is called the explicate or unfolded order, which is a special and distinguished form contained within the general totality of all the implicate orders. So don't worry if you don't understand that, but to me it's quite remarkable how resonant it is with these very old kind of direct apprehensions of the nature of being, that wisdom traditions have passed on to us. Okay, so from the esoteric realms of particle physics, let's go back to ancient China. During what's sometimes called the legendary period, so that's the 5th to the 8th centuries, the really beginning where this poem comes from, there weren't so many, there weren't monasteries. The Chan monks probably wandered as ascetics or practiced as hermits, much like the Taoists that preceded them. But gradually they acquired the support of wealthy patrons and established large monasteries. And over time and change of dynasties, Chan fell in and out of favor, particularly during times of regime change, and there would be sort of conservative revival of Confucian establishment values, and monasteries would be actually persecuted, so they retreated to the mountains. And began to take up farming in order to survive, because of course early monks were forbidden from engaging in farming and doing manual labor. So fortunes and dynasties would change, but over time Chan became highly institutionalized. But in the Tang Dynasty, that's about the 8th to the 10th centuries, came to be known as the classical period, or the golden age of Chan, and produced many of the great Zen masters whose names we know from the koan literature. One from that time, early in that time, who expresses the spirit of this poem particularly beautifully is Shurdo, and we chant his poem, Harmony of Difference and Equality, or sometimes it's translated Identity, Relative and Absolute. That's in our chant book, and many of you know it well, and you can, I think, see how it resonates with this earlier poem. So the Zen koan literature became a record over time of the stories of encounters and dialogues between these old Zen masters and their students. They were passed down orally and later compiled in collections, and then with commentaries added and verses added in what was called the literary period. So that's more like mid-10th to 13th centuries. Don't worry about these dates. But the reason I bring this history up is to see how this was and is a living, changing tradition. So I'm not going to trace or analyze the history anymore, but what I'd rather do is take two examples of these koans that refer directly to our poem hundreds of years later, and see how this was presented, you know, at another time in Chan history and practice. I think you could argue that the core purpose of these old encounters depicted in the koans, that the core purpose of using koans in our practice is to induce a direct understanding of what Sung Tsan is telling us in this poem. So both the koans I'm going to give you, and that's your extra piece of paper there, concern Zhao Zhou, who is one of the most revered and beloved Zen masters of all time, who lived from 778 to 897, which made him 116 or so. He lived a long life. He didn't start teaching till he was 80. I really love that. That would be best. So here's the first one. Zhao Zhou was teaching the assembly, and he said, "The ultimate path is without difficulty, just avoid picking and choosing. As soon as there are words spoken, this is picking and choosing. This is clarity. This old monk does not abide within clarity. Do you still preserve anything or not?" So a certain monk asked him, "Since you do not abide within clarity, what do you preserve?" Zhao Zhou replied, "I don't know either." The monk said, "Since you don't know, teacher, why do you nevertheless say that you do not abide within clarity?" Zhao Zhou said, "It is enough to ask about the matter, bow, and withdraw." So he begins by quoting the opening lines of our poem, right? And then he says, as soon as you say, not picking or choosing, you set up picking and choosing against the clarity of emptiness, right, or boundless mind. You set up a duality. And then he says, I don't abide in emptiness. I don't get stuck, even in emptiness. I don't get stuck there, and I don't get stuck in picking and choosing. And then he asked the monks, do you preserve anything or not? Is there anything to hold on to? Is there anything at all to hold on to, even the Dharma? So the monk tries to pin him down and asks, since you do not abide within clarity, what do you preserve? Of course, Jiajou refuses to be pinned down. Like old Bodhidharma, when Emperor Wu asked, who is this standing before me? He just says, I don't know. I don't know. So our poor monk is getting frustrated. Wouldn't you be a little frustrated by now? He desperately wants to figure this out. So he says, if you don't even know, how can you say you don't abide in clarity? And old Jiajou says, it is enough to ask about the matter, bow and withdraw. What a simple, humble answer. Just bow and withdraw. So Zen Master Shuedo, who collected the poem, this came from the Blue Cliff Record, and Shuedo collected the koans that appear in the Blue Cliff Record, and he wrote a verse for each one. So it's on your, the next thing you see on your sheet is Shuedo's verse in response to this koan. The ultimate path is without difficulty. The speech is to the point, the words are to the point. In one, there are many kinds. In two, there's no duality. On the horizon of the sky, the sun rises and the moon sets. Beyond the balustrade, the mountains deepen, the waters grow chill. When the skull's consciousness is exhausted, how can joy remain? In a dead tree, the dragon murmurs are not yet exhausted. Difficult, difficult. Picking and choosing, clarity, you see for yourself. So these images of the empty skull and the dragon and the withered tree come from a series of other koans and verses that grapple with what it is to be a living human being with a spacious, open mind. You know, how do we still live, how do we live in emptiness, in a living human body, in a world of suffering? So he says, freely the dragon still murmurs. A quiet joy remains in the empty skull. As long as we are alive, as long as we are alive. I could show you a whole series of other poems around that empty skull and the dragon in the withered tree, but that just gives you a little bit of the flavor of this Zen language. So there's one more koan that I'm going to give you about Old Man Jiajou, and this one appears in a collection of 300 koans that Dogen, who brought the Japanese monk who went to China in the 13th century and brought this tradition of practice back to Japan, established Soto Zen in Japan. And sort of a stereotype of Soto Zen is that it doesn't, it's not that concerned with koans. You know, that's a Rinzai Zen thing. But that's very much not the case. Dogen was very well, deeply, deeply steeped in this koan tradition. His writings are full of references to koans. He brought this collection of his 300 favorites back, and but what he doesn't do is practice with, as far as we know, koans in the systematized curriculum that later came to be used in Rinzai Zen. So it's good not to be afraid of koans in our practice. It's good to to be able to play with them a little, even. So Jiaozhou said to the monks, if you have even a bit of discrimination, you lose your mind in confusion. Again, he's referring directly to this old poem. What do you have to say about this? So one of the monks hit Jiaozhou's attendant and said, why don't you answer the master? Then Jiaozhou left, went back to the abbot's quarters. Later, the attendant came to him and asked for his guidance. He said, did that monk who hit me understand or not? And this was Jiaozhou's answer. The one who sits... Oh, is that a typo on your copy? Mm-hmm. Sorry. It should say, the one who sits sees the one who stands. The one who stands sees the one who sits. The one who sits sees the one who stands. The one who stands sees the one who sits. So can you imagine that scenario here? We don't go around hitting each other in the Zendo these days. But we are not free from habit patterns of comparing and judging mind, are we? You know, that even arises in the Zendo. And those habits are not so wholesome sometimes. So our practice gives us the opportunity to bring those habit patterns of judging mind to our attention and to see their insubstantial nature and to open up our view so that we're not cutting ourselves off from each other, from the world around us, and from ourselves. When we judge ourselves, how many people here have ever judged yourself? Oh, Brian hasn't. When we judge ourselves, we are otherizing ourselves. We're turning ourselves into the other, right? We're splitting our being in two or more. Sometimes we even have two opposing voices, judging voices, right? We can do that. We can argue. So our practice gives us the capacity to penetrate that phantom, those phantoms within us. These old teachings about non-duality passed down over the centuries are directly relevant to our contemporary lives. And in our last session, which is actually not going to be next week, it's going to be 2 weeks from now because I'm going to be away next week. So you can come next week and we'll do something else, but we'll do our final bit of this 2 weeks from now. And we'll read the last part of the text and we'll talk about how it's relevant to our lives in the 21st century. So what I'm going to get you to do together today is look at these koans, look particularly at this second one. And you can help each other with this. And how do you understand Jiaozhou's response to his attendant? The one who sits sees the one who stands. The one who stands sees the one who sits. Okay. When I read this, sort of imagined. The scenario here. What if I asked you, if you have even a bit of discrimination, you lose your mind in confusion. What do you have to say about this? And somebody went and gave Ben a slap and said, why don't you answer? And Ben would come afterwards and say, whoa, they hit me. Did they understand? Did there was something they got that I don't get? And then I would say, the one who sits sees the one who stands. The one who stands sees the one who sits. What is that? Okay, so I'm going to get you to sit, clump yourselves in groups of three.